This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Old ancestor Linji once said, "There's a true person of no position constantly going in and out through the portals of your face. If you don't know this for a fact, then look, look." Is this a pithy Zen inquiry instruction about verification? Knowing this for a fact, and in order to do so, looking. One nice thing I think about the inquiry practice is it keeps Zazen kind of fresh and interesting, especially in Sesshin Zazen. If you're just following the breath, just letting go of thoughts, it may become boring after a while. And something about this inquiry practice to me seems like it's not boring. Never seems to become boring. So in a way, it's a way to keep Zazen fresh and stay awake and bright and enthusiastic. One might say those very same reasons are the disadvantage of it, is that we're trying to spiff up this reality that is so ordinary and plain. And some might say, well, it keeps our active mind interested and engaged, but it's a little bit busy. So maybe the very pro is also a con, and the very con is also a pro regarding inquiry practice. Just to review the map a little bit more, without adding too much more. There's a lot on this map already, but I just find when I hear the map described in slightly different ways, it helps to keep clarifying the nuances of this subtle map of practice. So what may sound kind of repetitious and like, I keep hearing the same thing, maybe we hear it in a slightly different way. I would say that asking ourselves this question, is awareness present, or is presence present? Is there experiencing? That a three-year-old could ask herself, and maybe immediately verify it is so. What is experiencing? Not sure what it is, I can't get a hold of it, And yet, you must be experiencing, because I hear the question and I can consider the answer. And there are sounds being experienced and sights being experienced and thoughts and feelings being experienced. There must be experiencing whatever that is. Most obvious. And at the moment, there is the verification of experiencing. We could call that being aware of being aware, experiencing. We could call this a calm abiding practice. It might not be some particular liberating insight, but it's a way to totally settle without any particular object, unless we call awareness itself an object. It's not quite in that category. We could call this just sitting, if just sitting is a calm abiding practice. And then we could further ask, okay, I know there is a total knowing and confidence that awareness is present in a kind of obvious 3-year-old style confidence. Yeah, awareness is present. Don't ask me anything more about it at this point, but yeah, it's present. Then we could ask a little bit further and inquire, well, what is it that knows awareness is present? What is it that can so easily answer yes to this question? What is it that is so sure that experiencing is happening? What is that? See, it's a slightly different question. There is experiencing. And what is it that said yes? What is it before the word yes came? What is it that actually verifies this fact, the undeniable fact that presence is present? What would you say? What is it that that knows this is so? Any speculations? You do know that experiencing is happening right now, don't you? I mean, we're just talking about ordinary, plain old, ever-present awareness. I propose, without you even telling me, that actually you do all know this is so. And there's not even any doubt about it. If there's any doubt, then maybe we're just not clear about the words, but we're just talking about ordinary experiencing. It's happening, right? So then this question could be asked, what is it that knows that? What is it that knows experiencing is happening? Anyone like to enter a guess experientially, looking for what would be a theoretically correct answer? What does it actually feel like knows that? We're calling it a verification. A natural 3-year-old style verification. Yeah, experiencing is happening. That's a knowing, that experiencing happening. What is it that knows that? It's not a trick question or anything. There, is it? Okay, so Teresa says, consciousness knows. Exactly. Depending on what we mean here by consciousness, I think it's best not to use a different word, but let's see, is it Emmy who wanted to respond?
Because we're alive, so we have.
Because we're alive. So, like, what is the note? So you could say, like, life. Life is actually knows. The aliveness knows. And then
living, live.
Living knows that experiencing happening. It says this thing I refer to as myself knows. So I think these are all ways of saying it. Yeah. And maybe the most clear way, or maybe most interesting way to notice is, what I would propose is, what is it that knows awareness is present? Awareness. It's not some other. So we could call that consciousness, we could call that aliveness, life, and we could call that myself. I think, so all those are true. But rather than bringing in another term, which would create a kind of duality, right? That there's me that knows awareness, or there's life that knows awareness. How about just, aren't those actually synonyms for awareness? Could it be that actually there's not some or consciousness, you said too, a consciousness, if we're using it as a synonym for awareness, knows itself. What is it that knows? There is experiencing here. I know it. What is it that experiencing the fact that experiencing is happening? Experiencing is experiencing, experiencing. Awareness is aware of being aware. Knowing, know is knowing, knowing. No additional knower or separate self is needed to know this. And this is a point we could contemplate. Could it be that awareness is present? There's a knowing of this, a verifying. What is it that's verifying? The obvious fact that awareness is present. Awareness is verifying the obvious fact that it is present. As soon as we kind of be looking for some other verifier, but could it be that actually it's a self-verifying awareness? It's a self-illuminating knowing. Tom says a three-year-old would say, "I know." Yeah, they might say that, and then if we were to inquire further, once they're five or six and have a larger vocabulary, I'd ask, "Well, what do you mean by I?" And they would look. They might look and say, "Actually, that this I that I feel is that knows is actually just awareness. It's another name for it. Could be." Do you have a comment?
Yeah. So you asked the question. And my ear consciousness mixed up with my mind consciousness notified my awareness that this question had showed up. And and then I guess the awareness was aware that the ear and mind consciousness were working and verified that there was a question about what is the source of awareness. And it saw that the whole mix was a part of it. The ear mind consciousness, hearing the question, and the awareness is all. So there's the experiential and also the timeless, spaceless in that moment, isn't there?
Yeah,
unless we get that.
We could tell the story that way if we bring in this issue of, yeah, what about the question that's asking? Then we do have to include the ear consciousness and the conceptual mind consciousness that understands words and so on. That's true. That's undeniably true. Can we, this is part of the tricky business here. Can it be that the question that's coming kind of conceptual package with your consciousness and all, could it be that the question is just like inquiring about a direct non-conceptual knowing, before the question comes. And then the question does kind of distort it. And then you're right, we have then the whole package including the question. But it's almost like, can we ask this question in the way like, I'm asking it in this conceptual question, but I'm asking about what is it? The question's almost asking a little from the side in this conceptual way. What is it that actually, was able to definitively feel and trust that awareness is present before the question's asked. And then we can say, well, actually, it seemed like when I look into that, that it was just awareness verifying itself. And then the question is just kind of like, is kind of creating a kind of story around that. Koren.
But what is aware of the awareness? I'm not getting an experiential click. Like I feel, I don't feel like I'm verifying that. And the only way that I was trying to turn it, it seemed to me I could do a process of elimination, to kind of say, well, is it my thinking mind? And that doesn't seem right because the awareness doesn't seem to have, it's not the container of experience doesn't seem to be dependent on conceptual mind, but.
That's right. That's a good one. That's a good point you just made.
But mm-hmm. could you give us a little bit more help on how to experientially verify that awareness is being
mm-hmm. I think that's part of what you said, this kind of deduction. Well, it can't be the thinking mind that, the thinking mind also does know that awareness is present. When we say the word yes or have the thought, yes, it's present, the thinking mind's already coming in there. But it's like trying to kind of catch it before the answer yes comes. We could even say, between asking the question, what knows awareness is present, and the answer, awareness knows, is already a thought. You could say there's the actual direct experience, or take the first question. We ask the question, is awareness present? And then just before the answer, yes comes, it's slightly conceptualized verification. There's a pre-verbal verification, like really knowing, yeah, it is present. And then a second later, it's like, well, I'm supposed to answer the question with a word, yes. And now it's a little bit conceptually packaged. So, and then regarding this point, what is it that knows awareness is present? And we say, it's not the conceptual mind that knows it because it doesn't seem to depend on the concept. It was already there before the conceptual mind tries to know it. And we inquire deeply, we thoroughly investigate this present experience and try to stay closely with the experiencing, the being aware, and we keep tasting the verification. Yes, this is awareness. I'm like confirming this three-year-old verification. Yes, it, without a doubt, feeling more and more sure awareness is present always, anytime I check. Yes, it is. I can't get a hold of it. Yes, it is. And maybe even the stronger the sense of confidence that yes, it is, the more it starts to dawn on us that confidence is coming from awareness itself. And then nothing else is needed in addition to it. So it's definitely an inquiry. And I think we can stay with the question if it doesn't feel like it's moving anything, shifting anything. We can stay with it and see if it does. Also, we can now you've heard the answer, but there's no additional thing, that awareness is just aware of itself. We can try on that story. That's kind of a map, conceptual story. We can try that on and see if that rings true. Yeah, I actually can, if I'm looking for something that is being aware of being aware, it couldn't be anything other than the awareness itself. So this is almost like we give away the answer and then we try on the answer. I think that also works with inquiry. Unlike, say, traditional koan practice, where you're like, not going to give the answer, to keep inquiring until you come up with it. Here we can say, well, here's an answer that, a potential answer. You shouldn't just take it on faith, though. Try on this answer. I think that can also work. And can that make sense? That and does it make more sense than anything else that awareness would be aware of itself without anything additional needed? You would say maybe there's the additional thing needed of conceptual consciousness in order to tell the story about it, and to tell somebody, yeah, awareness is aware of itself. Now we're adding this other layer. Can we, at the very time of Zazen, can there be a kind of going right into that, to this very experiencing, sense the kind of knowing of it and verify that nothing else is needed. And then we have Dharma teachings that say, there's some debate about this point, but even in Indian Buddhist philosophy, this is generally a Mahayana teaching, that awareness is self-knowing, it's self-illuminating, it's reflexive, is a technical term, not reflective. Reflexive means self-illuminating, self-knowing, self-verifying, and because there's some debate about this, it's a subtle point. And we can see if we resonate more with that story than the fact that awareness can't know itself and it needs something else to know it. That would be the other argument. We can try on these stories experientially. Let's see. Who's that? Hogan?
This is Hogan. Hi. Koji. Can you hear me?
A little bit. Can you speak louder?
Yeah, maybe I'll come. Maybe that will get. There we go. Thanks, Doug. What I'd like to offer something. Something keeps coming up for me. A teaching that I heard recently, which pointed out that as we were trying to be aware of our world, the senses that we typically rely upon in the way we talk about them or think about them, like sight, sound, touch. Almost all these things are based in differentiating between one thing or another. And that extends to our sort of regular egoic thinking as well. A lot of that is based in, is this different than that? Or am I sensing a difference in that? And this teaching suggested that there is a very underused and underrecognized sense organ that we all actually have, which is more based on feeling and knowing the sameness of everything. And I heard an encouragement to try to cultivate that, you know, rather than try to cultivate that sense organ that we all have, which is maybe the part of awareness that knows there is awareness, but slips away when I slipped towards the clumsy habitual language of, is this the same as that? Or is this different than that? Am I seeing this? Can I put a name on it? But again, I want to come back to that feeling that I get seems to be very helpful when I hear that idea that there is part of us, part of awareness itself, that is there to feel and know wholeness and sameness. And it's vastly under cultivated and underutilized. I wanted to throw that out there.
Yes, yeah, I think that's right, that the five sense faculties are all knowing objects separate from themselves. So they're based around duality. And there's five of them, or six if you include the conceptual mind. And so we're very used to that dualistic perception, even before conceptual thinking, the senses are set up and seem to be arranged in this duality of subject and object, like eyes and colors and ears and sounds. Yes, and I think we could say, I think I maybe even mentioned this earlier in Sashin, that it's almost like a sense, faculty. It's usually not called this way, Buddha Dharma, but it's kind of like that, the sense of being aware. And yeah, and it's different from all the other ones, which is why it takes some getting used to it, because it's the only one you could say that's not relating to an object apart from itself. Self-knowing awareness is a different kind of knowing than any other kind of knowing. And you could say, well, we all do have that faculty, and it's underused. Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. It's underappreciated because we're really into relating to apparently external objects. Also, the teaching says, and this is like Indian Yogacara system that proposes that there is this self-illuminating, self-knowing awareness, like a lamp that illuminates the room and also illuminates itself at the same time. Is the analogy given. And it said in the system that this is true in every moment of consciousness. Like we're looking at an image right now, and at the same time we're looking at the image, simultaneously, awareness is aware of itself looking at the image. That's the proposal. And so we can try to thoroughly investigate this in our own experience and see, does that seem to be so? It's subtle point. We can check. But the second question, that's quite a bit harder than the first, right? First question being, is awareness present? And the second question being is, what is it that knows awareness is present? Awareness knows. If this is so, if this can be verified, then we could say that is a that is awareness verifying itself, which we've been talking about. And that's always the case. Awareness is always verifying itself. And then we have this kind of thorny issue of how does that get relayed to the person, to the individual consciousness that can form concepts and words and so on. And that's where we could say the letters from emptiness, from this direct verification, are arriving in dualistic consciousness. And then we might say, but then don't we, as soon as we start talking about it or have a personal recognition of this event that we can talk about, then doesn't that distort it and diminish it and defile it? We might feel that way at first, but then we could say, if we're taking the whole picture into account, we could say, but this so-called defiling, distorting conceptual version of this is just the play of awareness expressing itself within awareness. So you could say, yes, the concept is a sort of picture of reality, and yet the picture is made of the reality. The true nature of the conceptual stories that we're telling is non-conceptual knowing, manifesting as these Dharma stories, these kind of like paintings of rice cakes are actually made of true inconceivable rice.
Thank you.
So I would say these first two questions, if we put them like, is awareness present? Is there experiencing? Yes. What is it that's experiencing? It's just experiencing itself, which I would say almost like the second question isn't really much of a further insight from the first question. It's just really, I feel like it drives home the point of non-duality even further. It nails that peg of non-duality a little more deeply into the ground. It's almost like, it's so hard to talk about this, right? There's a little different feeling, I feel like, the second question. It almost solidifies in a nice way the first point. It solidifies, not a very good word in this kind of talk. I would say like it the verification becomes a little bit stronger with the second question, but it's not maybe the most essential matter. But maybe I would say, if we're talking about the shamatha and vipassana, I would still put, there's little inquiries here, but I would still put these first two questions in the category of calm abiding or shamatha. And now there can be awareness, just being aware of itself, with nothing else needed. And this is calm, present. It is called presence now. But it's not yet insight into non-duality, really. The non-duality of awareness and the world. This is what we're interested in. We're interested in leaving the cushion and entering the life of sights and sounds and all this in a non-dual way. So this first type of being aware is a good calm abiding practice on the cushion, but it still might feel as if there's a kind of contained awareness with nothing other than itself, but how do we relate to the world from this awareness? And that's where Vipassana can come in, which is questioning the timelessness and locationlessness. And this is where it starts to get inclusive, right? Of just being aware isn't necessarily including the entire universe within itself, right? It's just the fact that awareness is aware. But if we start to investigate that it has no boundaries, which would mean everything is within itself, and that it doesn't come and go, which means it's not a conditioned state, then this is the realm where the insight into non-duality is really starts cooking. So I'd say being aware is a calm abiding practice, but it's not really a realization of non-duality yet without these further inquiries that are, you know, particularly investigating the relationship of awareness to everything, every experience. It's investigating the relationship of experiencing, which is a name for awareness or presence, the relationship of experiencing to experiences, which are these temporary phenomena. What's the relationship between them? That's where we're getting into non-duality that can function in the realm of differences and things in a non-dual way. So that would be like the Vipassana part. And people might say, well, just being aware in a stable way, that's amazing. That's, how could Zazen ever go beyond that? This was like kind of maybe a high standard version of Zazen and say, that's great. That's calm abiding without any particular object, but it can go further. This thorough investigation, like in this essay of Dogen, endlessly further. And then we could also have the question of, this could be a momentary, and each one of these verifications could be a momentary glimpse of direct non-conceptual and non-dual verification. And then there can be, it can immediately send a letter to the conceptual mind that can kind of like, you know, plot that into the map for future reference. And knowing that the conceptual story about it is actually made of the awareness itself, then it's not a problem. If we know the nature of the conceptual story, and then how to, so this is just a moment, but then how to stabilize that and extend that, say in Zazen, should one then keep asking the question? Usually not. If there's really is kind of moment of verification where it's like, yes, this is how it is, then the practice to extend it, I would propose, is quite interesting. This practice to stabilize and extend this verification is not do anything at all. Not to try to maintain, okay, this is such a start, it's all lined up here. Just like focus, say it's already, that's now we're getting too involved in it. It's more like we're just letting it be. And it, in a way, it has its own momentum. It's a self-sustaining verification that lasts as long as it lasts. But if we try to make it last, that usually doesn't work, and it gets too conceptual. So we just verify, and then this like just let it, let the verification be, and rest, just rest in this realm, and the freedom of this realm, and not grasping any for anything, not conceptually grasping, not fixating on any part of it, not trying to maybe even not trying to go in there and say, yeah, that's a verification, but let's check again to make sure. I already maybe too much. And just wait for it to fade, which in what we call fade, actually, I think doesn't mean that the verification really fades. It just means that conceptual thinking and habitual patterns start to fade into it, or start to, you know, emerge into it. It really doesn't change, but we have a lot of momentum of from lifetimes of conceptual thinking, so that starts to come in and overlay it again. And if we're talking about these two dimensions of calm abiding, just being presence, but it's not boundless presence yet. Here we're saying calm abiding is presence, and then with the Vipassana added, we can confirm that it's boundless and timeless presence. Say we get to the sense, our seventh sense, whatever it is, our true sense that we all have, that presence is boundless and timeless. We don't do anything about it. We just let that go until maybe just a little bit of habitual pattern comes in. And the step down would be that the balanced presence kind of sinks back into just plain old presence. In other words, the union of shamatha and vipassana, boundless, timeless presence, slips back into just plain presence of being aware, but the sense of really vast spaciousness, really vast timelessness and locationlessness, that contracts a little bit due to habitual patterns. And now we're back in just presence, which is pretty good, right? It's being aware and being really present with that. Without too much, there can be thoughts going on, but they're not totally derailing it. That's pretty good. But you can see there's a very subtle difference. And then from that basis or platform of just presence, being aware, at some point we can maybe, trigger, we can then bring the inquiry in again. We've kind of let it fade back a little bit on its own. And we inquire again, well, are there any boundaries or coming and going? And then maybe it opens back into boundless, timeless presence. And then we don't do anything about that. We just let it sustain itself for as long as it does. And then maybe we slip back into shamatha again. Pretty good. And then we can kind of go back and forth between these two. It's very slightly different. Or a big, we get totally derailed with like what's for lunch or something. And then we can start at the beginning again. Like, okay, is awareness present? Yeah. Shamatha. And then the qualities of this awareness, we're investigating the qualities called timelessness and boundlessness. So these are just like trying to flesh out the map a little bit.
When you and Doug were talking, and you mentioned about awareness, and Doug mentioned about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, it's kind of tickling awareness. That's the way I kind of paraphrase it. So that kind of evoked like the koan, what's the sound of one hand clapping? and which makes no logical sense. But awareness would be the sound of one hand clapping.
There's definitely a connection there. Yeah.
It was, wow. I can't put it back because it was so far back, but it was something like that. And then the other thing,
I'm like sorry. Being aware of being aware, there's no duality.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you what this actually, this being aware of being aware, evoked the feeling of looking into a mirror, awareness looking into a mirror. Then just the way my mind works is like, okay, what if I step back and I ask, what is the awareness that's aware of awareness? So then one more mirror. So then you can kind of like by induction go further and have many mirrors. And in the end, in a sense, you see that either it leads to craziness or like giving up any notion of any mirrors.
Ah, that sounds better than craziness. Yeah. So I think often people say this when we ask this question, well, what is it that knows awareness is present? And people were saying things like consciousness. They were using different words, right? And that's a little bit like, yeah, there's one mirror that's reflecting another mirror that's another. Sometimes people talk that way. I think it's not so helpful. I think it's best to say there's only one mirror that is knowing itself, like a lamp illuminating itself.
Stop before you go crazy, you mean?
Before you go crazy, yeah. Before you get into an infinite regress of infinite mirrors, which is kind of crazy and also kind of dualistic, right? It's not that the mind splits. Our usual dualistic mind does seem like it's split into a subject observing an object, but awareness itself, that's the whole beauty of it, is that it's not split into a knower and a known, and one part of awareness being aware of another part of awareness is kind of like dualistic consciousness works. And rather than that, we can say there's only one awareness and it's illuminating itself, which is a little unusual because all the other consciousnesses are not like that. So, and that's why there's even some debate about whether this is so in the Buddhist tradition. But I think it's more, it feels more experiential to me to say, to when I ask, what is it that's aware of awareness right now? It's the very awareness that is aware, and there's nothing in addition to it, and it's self-illuminating. It rings true for me. So. And then so Tom asked in the chat here, the sentence didn't get finished. It says, is awareness mediated by the senses? Yes, it is finished. Is awareness mediated by the senses? The relationship of the senses to this all-inclusive awareness that we're talking about is, I would say, like, the senses are part of the functioning, part of the magical display of awareness. There's one awareness. Again, the mirror metaphor works nicely here. The coffee brought up the mirror too. This mirror is awareness. And instead of adding another mirror, we just say the mirror is aware of itself. And if there's no images on the mirror, then it's just the mirror being the mirror. That's like self-knowing awareness. And then if there's reflections on it, which means that the mirror gives rise to images, then those images in their true nature are just the mirror, but they're appearing as experiences that are coming and going. And then Tom's question about the senses. So this like seeing, we could say, first of all, we could take like the eye faculty, the eye organ, we could say that's an appearance on the mirror. The true nature of the eye faculty is nothing but awareness. And the color that it's seeing is another reflection on the mirror. It's nothing but awareness itself. And the actual seeing, that's like the, it's the interaction between the eye and the color. We call the eye consciousness. In Buddhist language is always vijnana. It always means divided knowing. It's always consciousness, if we mean vijnana, is always dualistic, even the sense consciousnesses. So you could say that that appearance of a dualistic consciousness, that you could say it's a dualistic knowing of a color. You could say that event is another reflection on the surface of the unchanging non-dual mirror, which starts to get a little weird with this metaphor, because the act of seeing is a reflection produced by all-encompassing, inconceivable, boundless presence. It's taking the form of seeing, and seeing is a kind of awareness, actually. But if it seems to be divided into an eye faculty and a color, then that sense of duality is such an appearance on the mirror, a reflection in the mirror. I don't know exactly what you mean by mediated by the senses. I would say this kind of awareness, if we mean, is it kind of changed or influenced by the senses? I would say no, because this awareness is unchanging. It's not influenced by anything at all. It's always exactly the same. The mirror never changes. But because the awareness itself does influence phenomena like seeing and hearing. But it's a unidirectional influence. Nothing influences the mirror, but the mirror influences actually everything. It creates everything, it manifests everything. Its influence is unlimited, but it is not influenced by the world, because the world is an appearance within itself. Whereas dualistic consciousness, it's, you know, the sense of me, Kokyo, knowing the world, that consciousness is influenced by the senses and by the world. And that's the interdependent realm. Consciousness, dualistic consciousness, is an interdependent phenomena. But this non-dual, self-illuminating, boundless, ever-present, ungraspable, inconceivable, timeless knowing of awareness is independent. It doesn't depend on anything. It's unconditioned. Let's see. Tressa says, what do you mean by extended? Extend off the cushion? How? I like the idea of resting the mind. Isn't that the conceptual mind telling the mind to rest? P.S. I'm aware that my battery needs to be extended. Be right back. extended means kind of like in the realm of time, which we're kind of saying is an illusion that appears within awareness. So from the point of view of awareness, this is clunky language. We already said it's a problem to say that awareness has a point of view, but from the perspective, right, of awareness, as awareness itself, awareness doesn't have any need for being extended or have the idea of extension through time. It's unchanging. Extension is in the realm of time and change. So it's not really that it is ever extended, it's beginningless and endless and unchanging. But for the realm of like the person that lives in the appearance of time, then we could say there's there's the kind of appearance of extending the confirmation over time into all our activities, because that's, of course, important to us as people. So you bring up a good point here that actually extension is a kind of a relative idea for the person. And then, as I mentioned, I guess I was talking about on the cushion, you extend it by not doing anything, just resting in it. You say off the cushion could be the same. We could have a little confirmation in any situation. It's easier to learn on the cushion, as I said, because we're not doing anything else. But then it's possible to throughout the day, especially like if we just stop doing everything for a minute, like a Tassajara in the kitchen, they have a mindfulness bell. I think they got it from Thich Nhat Hanh. So there's like 20 people like super busy in the kitchen, try to be silent, but it's a whirlwind of activity, trying to produce a meal for 140 people every few hours. So it's like this whirlwind of activity and there's sharp knives flying through the air, these sorts of things. And then somebody will ring every once in a while, surprise time, they'll ring the bell and it means everybody stop, let the flying knives fall to the floor. All the movement just totally stops. And they say, just breathe. It's a mindfulness bell to just be present. Like a 20 second shamatha period, it's totally present. Sometimes the contrast of the intense busyness and activity when the bell rings actually helps. It's easier to be present when there's so much activity that suddenly stops, almost like because we notice the contrast. It feels really present, maybe sometimes vividly present. So one could practice a moment of shamatha at that point, but like being aware, even that, probably not so many people think of it that way. They're just, I'm going to follow my breath for 20 seconds. But if one had the practice, I'm just going to be aware, being aware, just be aware. Then one could practice that kind of shamatha. But if one also is developing this vipassana kind of practice of like being able to kind of quickly ask, is there any time or space here? And if we get used to this inquiry, it can take place in a second. If we're making this track so quickly. Are there any edges? Is there any coming and going? Nope. And then we could use the so-called mindfulness bell to verify non-dual reality for 20 seconds in the middle of activity. In a momentary gap from activity. And that would be a way to extend, or maybe to verify off the cushion. And then maybe now we're talking kind of pretty advanced practice here. But if we're kind of making these pathways, getting used to them, then slowly people pick up the knives, start cutting the vegetables again, right? You could say, now can we extend the spacious, timeless presence that we just verified by stopping? Now can we extend it into cutting the vegetables for even 3 seconds would be amazing. But eventually Buddha could maybe keep chopping the vegetables and in the sense of timelessness and spacelessness. So I think it's really important to know here that this timeless, spaceless realm doesn't mean like it becomes some sort of zombie and can't cut vegetables. At first, on the cushion, maybe feels that way too. In the direct verification, it's like, and the slightest activity feels like it will disturb it. But the ideal map that goes infinitely far could be that we're now cutting the vegetables, but there's this sense of all the activities here, the sense of holding the knife, the smell of the vegetable, the other people in the room, all of this is like the non-dual display of awareness, made of awareness. All this is reflections on the mirror, and we can be engaged and carefully attend to the reflections while at the same time verifying that all this is actually, the nature of all this is unchanging presence. It's quite challenging, but this would be like the possibility. Mitsu says, everyone has awareness, but not everyone understands awareness. In other words, that it's boundless presence. This is the fundamental ignorance that is the basis of suffering. Yeah, I think we could say that. The fundamental ignorance. Different schools of Buddhism will talk about the fundamental ignorance differently. This is a maybe the most subtle version of the fundamental ignorance that's the basis of suffering. Not verifying, particularly the boundless, timeless nature of self-knowing awareness. And why is this the basis of suffering? We talked about it a little bit, but let's not forget this point. Anyone want to say it in any way? Why is the non-verification of boundlessness and timelessness of awareness the root of suffering, discontent? Anyone want to try it out? Corinne?
Kokyo, could you talk about Dharma position in relation to extending this awareness off the cushion? And also, doesn't the song of the trusting mind also, I don't want to say embellish, but point the way of interacting in the conditioned reality?
Yes. Well, I think hopefully all these Zen poems and teachings do. But that one, yeah, I mean, maybe one there's many amazing teachings in about these very points that we're bringing up in the Xin Xin Ning, the Song of the Trusting Mind. And but maybe the most famous lines at the very beginning. The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. Even if we could say that's kind of like bringing this teaching of non-duality into the relative world of activity. It doesn't, I like to translate it anyway as not holding preferences. It doesn't mean we don't have preferences. That's, I think, going too far. But, I'd rather have vanilla than chocolate, but if there's no vanilla around, chocolate's fine. Because, and how does it relate to this teaching? Because the vanilla and chocolate are equally of the nature of the mirror. So we can still play with chocolate and vanilla, but if we remember what they're made of, and we're not that hung up on the difference between vanilla and chocolate. This is hard. And then your question about Dharma position, which is a Dogen teaching, I think you're referring to. He might have gotten from the Chiantai tradition, but each thing is abiding in its Dharma position. In the Gendo Koan, he says this, and I think it's something like, independent of past and future and includes past and future. Karmic position is like that. So this very much relates. You could say the reflection on the mirror, again, works very nice as a way to talk about Dharma position. In its true nature, our Dharma position, you could just say, anything being itself, this person manifesting in this particular way is its Dharma position. It's includes past and future, it includes time and so on. And it's independent of past and future because it is just the mirror, which is completely which has no past and future, the timeless mirror, like that. And nobody answered this question about how it is that not verifying timelessness and spacelessness, non-dual awareness, let's say, is the root of suffering.
Because it means there's still a sense of separateness.
And
when there's a sense of separateness, there's suffering.
That's very good, yeah. There's no sense of separateness. And we could also say that if there's separateness, then the object seems to be external, and we have some aversion or grasping for external objects. As soon as they're external, almost we can't help it. And another way, if the separateness is, then we feel like I'm a perceiver and a separate self over here. So yeah, that sense of separateness, reified objects and reified subject is the root of suffering. And now Tom has a question. You're muted.
No, I didn't have a question.
Oh. you had a gosh show that was
I guess I was thinking.
Yeah, or you were paying homage to all the Buddhas in the 10 directions.
That is true. And all of you.
Thank you. Pamela.
Yes, I'm going back a little to your statement about non-duality. They can function in relationship in a non-dual way. And thinking about the way we respond off the cushion and how that seventh sense, what did we call it? Sixth sense? I don't know, whatever number that was. That is the awareness, like in being extended in that moment when we respond in a way that is full of that, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is an example of the non-duality functioning in a relationship in a non-dual way, maybe.
Yes, yeah. And it could be that it's, we're painting a really elaborate conceptual map here this week, right? It could be that it's, experientially, it's almost simpler. It's more just like that sense, it's a nice way of talking about it, the sense that awareness is present always, which means timeless, and that it's really all-inclusive and there's nothing outside of it. That sense could become more and more natural. It's not like we're constantly having to ask the questions, just a more and more natural sense, especially if we say that that's reality. It's not a contrived thing that we've sort of brainwashed ourselves into thinking. We're just getting more in touch with how it actually is, kind of undoing our karmic brainwashing. So then, without even knowing it, it could be that this sense of that's how it is affecting our relationships with people and things. It's naturally permeating into our daily life despite ourselves. And this is what you could say, this is the path part. This is because of this training on the cushion, it naturally percolates into our lives. And I think even if we put aside the most deep, nuances of non-duality, we could say just something happens in Sesshin. We all know this as Sesshin sitters. And that after Sesshin, our life is a little different for a little while. Usually, right? Things are a little more free-flowing. Things are And we may not have this super elaborate conceptual map that we're creating here to explain it, but we all, I think that's why we're doing it. That's why we keep doing it. That's why it's so painful. And even after finishing one, we want to do it again because we have some sense. It's like our Buddha nature itself is like, yeah, we're on the right track. Do that again. But it's so painful. It's like I have to like sit like that and can't do anything else. Yeah, but you know, sign me up for the next one. So you could say that's our intuitive sense that it does work this way. And maybe there's all kinds of gradation. Even just calm abiding without the full non-duality, you could say the calm abiding percolates into our lives, and we're more present and less reactive. It's all good. Now Dogen says that he must finish this essay before this session ends. The king of samadhis, samadhi, Dogen says, summing it up in conclusion in a pretty straightforward way, after the first ancestor Bodhidharma came from the West, for a period of 9 years, he sat cross-legged during Zazen facing a wall at Shaolin Monastery on Mount Sung, Shaoshu Peak. So that's the famous story. Bodhidharma just faced the wall in the meditation posture for 9 years, this celebration. And remember that in this day, cross-legged sitting, keikafuza, and meditation posture means a physical body sitting upright on a cushion, and it means boundless presence, the total world of Zazen. The person sitting in a perfect posture, which is always perfect, is a reflection on the surface of the mirror of the total realm of Zazen. The true nature of this posture with its sore butt and aching back is unchanging suchness, completely free from any fixation on time, space, pleasure, and pain simultaneously. And so you could say this is the cross-legged thing that Bodhidharma brought from the West. Long before Bodhidharma came to China, Buddhism was flourishing in China, and people seemed to be sitting in the cross-legged posture already. But here, Dogen says, ever since this time Bodhidharma arrived up until the present day, crowns of the head and clear eyes have been found everywhere throughout China. Zen phrases for crown of the head could be the pinnacle of truth, and clear eyes could be verification of it. The lifeblood of the first ancestor's Dharma artery is just cross-legged sitting. This is again this term myo myaku. The life vein is the living blood of the ancestral lineage. The lifeblood of the ancestral lineage of the Zen tradition is just cross-legged sitting, upright in the midst of boundless, timeless presence. before Bodhidharma arrived in China, cross-legged sitting was totally unknown. After he arrived, it became widely known. So this is how we could understand that that posture seemed to be practiced before Bodhidharma, but the true understanding that this posture is boundless, timeless presence itself, with not the slightest gap between the upright posture and the timeless presence. We could say that before Bodhidharma, this was not known. After he arrived, it became widely known. For this, and then Dogen is kind of referring to this phrase from the ancestor Zhaozhou. Zhaozhou once said, if for your entire lifetime you don't leave the monastery, the term for monastery here is Soren, which is a kind of poetic name for Zen monasteries that literally means forest thicket. Forest thicket is a name for Zen monasteries. So you hear that as like it's a place where there's a whole bunch of trees sitting upright together in one forest. And they were maybe Zen monasteries where you see out in the mountains in rural places. So literally it's Zhaozhou says, if for your entire lifetime, you don't leave the forest thicket. You could also say forest thicket is a community of practitioners. We could also say it's the thicket, it's the thick of life, it's the living, growing thick of life. All these, the monastery, the community of practitioners together, never alone, and the brambles and thorns in the forest thicket. If for a lifetime one doesn't leave this forest thicket and doesn't talk for 15 years, no one will ever call you mute, Zhaozhou says. After that, even Buddha can't do anything to you. If you don't, so this is kind of maybe a kind of monastic admonition. Don't think of leaving. Don't think of that there's anywhere else. If you're in the monastery, he's talking to people in the monastery. Don't leave where you are. And there's no need to say anything. And if you don't talk it off for 15 years, no one will call you mute. This is Zhaozhou's koan. Everything is being completely expressed in your silence. And after that, Buddha can't even do anything to you. So that's Zhaozhou's story, and Dogen's kind of referring to it here. Dogen says, for this reason that the Bodhidharma brought meditative posture of boundless presence from the West, and now it's thriving. For this reason, when for one lifetime or 10,000 times, from beginning to end, one does not leave the forest thicket, the community, and engages single-mindedly in cross-legged sitting from morning to night to the exclusion of all else, that is the king of samadhis, samadhi. Does he mean you should never leave your zafu? Or does he mean you should never leave boundless presence from morning to night to the exclusion of all else? Boundless presence, practice boundless presence to the exclusion of all else. But remember that boundless presence is all inclusive. It cannot exclude anything. So this is not so exclusive to say that just practice boundless presence, excluding everything else. because that would be impossible to exclude anything else. This is the king of samadhi, samadhi. John.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is, where it says the second month, do you think that's like a lunar month, so it would be more like March, April, or do you think that's like February?
This might be the kind of question that's not that important. However, we do hear that this essay was delivered on the 15th day of the second month, which in either case, whether it's the lunar or solar month, it's interesting that in East Asia, the 15th day of the second month happens to be Parinirvana day of the Buddha. The Buddha's complete freedom day. The Buddha's altogether complete liberation beyond birth and death. In the second year of Kangen, 1244, at Kipo Hermitage in the province of Echizen. At a particular time and place, this timeless, placeless, cross-legged sitting was expounded by first ancestor in Japan, Eihei Dogen Daisho, for the benefit of us today. Nenzen-san. Is that your hand or a previous hand?
It was a previous hand, but I did want to say something. So you read my mind, you read my hand. This last sentence I think is really interesting about engaging single-mindedly in the thicket. I like the forest thicket of life. And it seems to be suggesting that somehow we can, as an expression of awareness, this body being, as an expression of awareness, can be meeting every other expression of awareness all the time.
We can be. And we are, and it can be verified or not all the time and beyond time. We can make the vow to confirm and verify this meditation posture in its upright expression, meeting others and with an upright expression, and in the boundless presence where we actually don't meet because there's no separate beings to meet. All simultaneously. And it does seem like a kind of a strong encouragement at the end here, like after Dogen says this, like, now, like, do it. Bodhidharma brought this from the West for us. Now it's known now for this lifetime or 10,000 lifetimes, however many appear. Within this boundless presence, may we vow to use each of these lifetimes to verify our non-separation for the benefit of all beings. And to help us along the way, any merit that's been gathered over this week through our wholehearted sitting and through our wholehearted discussions amongst wonderfully devoted sangha of wayfarers. May all this merit and virtue be offered to all beings throughout space and time, that they may also verify the king of samadhis.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.